pretty tough, to be honest. Like the tough part of it also was there wasn't really a decent offer on the table. I don't think they tried their best to keep me, but I mean it's a part of the business, and they have probably other plans. So that's the business we're in. So you move on, and I think Nashville was the best fit for me. I'm at a point in my career, I just don't want to play hockey games. I want to win hockey games.
With Granny and Bischoff, featuring Greg Salerno.
I didn't know about Brady, but I know about the rumors of Stammer, and at some point today I called him. Me and him, we played together in Tampa, so I gave him a call, and we were like, yeah, we're doing it. So we were like, well, congrats. And he said, well, congrats to you too. So it was a pretty comical situation, but we're definitely excited to go there over there together.
On ESPN Las Vegas.
Today's going to be a fun show. Greg Salerno's in. Greg seems like he's having fun today. How you doing, Greg?
Oh, I feel amazing. How are you doing?
You got a fun 24 hours coming up?
Yeah, whatever. It's fine.
Is it?
Yeah.
All right.
That's good.
All right. You ready to talk some hockey?
Sleep's dumb.
Yes. I want to.
I'm excited because Greg's going to talk hockey and soccer to start the show.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
His wheelhouse of topics is great. Hockey and soccer. Here we go.
The First Bite.
Did the Golden Knights want to keep Jonathan Marchessault?
You heard there at the start of the show, Jonathan Marchessault on TSN say, the tough part is there wasn't really a decent offer on the table. I don't think they tried their best to keep me, but that's part of the business, and they probably have other plans. That's the business we're in, so you move on. Kelly McCrimmon called Jonathan Marchessault a liar yesterday.
Oh, geez.
McCrimmon said that couldn't be further from the truth.
Well, we saw it's the truth because he signed for like $5 million, was it $5.5
million?
$5 million. The Knights couldn't match that. They didn't want him. It's not a bad thing, but just being honest and say, hey, you know, we didn't want to do that.
Ultimately, Kelly McCrimmon said they didn't want to give Marchessault a five-year deal. Marchessault got 5 years and $5.5 million per season. McCrimmon said the data doesn't support signing Jonathan Marchessault to a five-year deal. He's going to be 34 next year. He'll be 38 when that contract ends. I don't think he's wrong in that regard.
Yeah.
I think it's probably smart to not give Jonathan Marchessault the five-year deal. I still am shocked he's only signed for $5.5 million. The part that I'm curious about from Marchessault's comment is when he said there wasn't really a decent offer on the table.
Which means that he didn't even probably get close to $5.5 million.
Like that. Like, what is decent to Jonathan Marchessault? Because I have to imagine if the Golden Knights offered 4 years at $5.5 million, Marchessault would have said, "Well, that's a decent offer."
Right.
Even if he takes the Nashville one. So they didn't offer 4 years at $5.5 million. Did they offer 3 at $5.5 million? Did they even offer $5.5 million?
Did they even offer anything?
They did offer.
Okay. We know for a fact there was an offer.
Just not a decent one.
All right.
So, like, we don't know exactly what it was, but, like, did the Golden Knights offer Jonathan Marchessault a 3-year contract worth $4 million?
Probably.
Because if that's what they offered, then he's right. They did not want him back.
Well, we know they didn't want him back, though. I mean, if they wanted him back, he'd be back. That's not an – even, like you said, 4 years, he probably would have at least considered it. Or you could just, you know, all right, look, we're not going to give you the fifth year. We'll give you an extra million a year for the 4 years, like big deal, whatever. They didn't want him. And I'm not saying that's bad or good. I'm just saying it's obvious they did not want him back.
I think ultimately not signing him to a five-year deal is the right thing to do, right? I the data not support, I 100% agree with that. Jonathan Marchessault just had his best career season at 33. That's not going to happen again, most likely. The aging curve of players, Jonathan Marchessault's probably going to have, he's peaked as a player.
Right.
So the chances of him being an extremely productive player when he's 36, 37, and 38, pretty low, right? I doubt Jonathan Marchessault is going to be a great player. 5.5, still not a lot of money, though. But Marchessault is probably going to be, you know, overpaid. It's probably going to be looked at as not a terrible contract because it's not that much, but it's probably going to be looked at as sort of like we don't really want this contract in the final 2 or 3 years of that deal. I think the problem, though, is the Golden Knights didn't do anything yesterday.
Right.
Like, you don't sign Jonathan Marchessault. Okay, that's fine. Like, he's going to be 38 at the end of that contract.
Sure, where's his replacement?
But they didn't, like, they had six free agents.
Mm-hmm.
All of them gone.
Well, like, it looks like somebody sat down in the offseason. You were talking about this yesterday, about getting younger, you know, instead of signing guys who were aging. And maybe they sat down and said, look, there's, you know, we got to redo this thing. We need a younger core. We'll see how it goes. Now, the problem is, if you're a fan, like, there's always a fan tax, what I call it. If you're going to sign a guy, not sign a guy the fans like, then sometimes you got to give him a little bit extra just to keep him around.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's what that fifth year would have been. But from a hockey standpoint, I've seen it. I've seen Chapman say it on social media, other people.
Oh, God, I agree with Chapman.
I know. You and Chris Chapman are on the same page.
I got to take my opinion back. Unbelievable they didn't sign him. Give him 10 years.
But other guys that, you know, do hockey, I've seen say this, that, you know, the fifth year would have been bad. But again, sometimes you do stuff like that because of the fans. So I don't know. We'll see what happens. But
the other part of this is that Kelly McCrimmon, after this season ended, said this was the best team in franchise history. Not the one that won the Stanley Cup
right.
The previous year. He said this year, the one that got bounced in the first round of the playoff was the best team in franchise history. And then six guys on that team were free agents, and they didn't sign any of them. And I think even worse than that, McCrimmon said yesterday, after the season ended, they only talked to one guy, Jonathan Marchessault, about a new contract.
Yeah.
So season ends, Kelly McCrimmon thinks he's got the best team he's ever had, and then he lets Jonathan Marchessault, Chandler Stephenson, Michael Amadio, Will Carrier, Anthony Mantha, Alec Martinez all leave, and he didn't talk to any of them except Marchessault. I don't think you can claim best team I've ever built and then just watch six guys walk out the door and not even have an interest in them.
Well, you could play devil's advocate and say the team's so good that we could afford to, like, cut some fat
or
whatever.
Not anymore. Six players. That's a third of the team.
Yeah, that's true.
That's a lot of guys.
Well, how many of these guys are over 30 that left?
All of them, I believe. Carrier might be right at it. Amadio might be under 30, but basically all of them are right at or are going to be 30 or older. But again, they didn't do anything yesterday.
No, you're
they
right.
They signed two AHL guys and a backup goalie who
sure.
We'll get to that later. He was horrible last year. They didn't like their replacements for these players are all going to have to be guys from within. They've got one of the worst prospect rankings in the entire NHL.
For trades, you mean?
They do not. Well, just guys calling up, like calling guys up from the AHL. They've got one of the worst prospect systems in all of hockey, and they're going to be relying on, like, three or four guys at this point.
And they don't have a lot of trade ammo because of the picks, right?
Yeah, they don't have any first-round picks for the next 2 years. The guy they just drafted in the first round is probably untradeable. So, like, yeah, what are they trading for if they want to add people? It's just... They lost 182 points yesterday in free agency. Their leading scorer from last year, their fifth leading scorer, and their 10th leading scorer all gone from the team, and they didn't bring in anybody. That's the part that's weird to me, is yes, I 100% get you let Jonathan Marchessault go, but then what else? Like, what, you let him go because you want that money to spend it somewhere else.
Yeah.
Where?
Well, again, I mean, I know they don't have a lot of ammunition, apparently, but it's going to have to be a trade. They're going to have to make a couple trades. They're going to need a goalie.
They're good on goalie now. They signed Ilya Samsonov to be the backup, who's not good. They've traded. They've added two goalies who are not good.
Oh, so they added another goalie on top of the other goalie.
They added Akira Schmid, and Kelly McCrimmon quickly said he's not the backup. He's the third stringer. And then yesterday they signed Ilya Samsonov, who Samsonov last year, let me find these stats to give you the exact numbers on it because it's great. Jesse Grange tweeted this out. Out of 96 goalies last season, Samsonov ranked 83rd in goals saved above expected. Of 65 goalies with at least 20 games, he ranked 61st in save percentage. They basically got one of the five worst goalies in hockey, and
wow.
He's their backup.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
Well, they got to do something because, again, the fans, you know, when you get used to success, you can't just go out there and be like, oh, guys, we're rebuilding this year or something like that. It doesn't work because all they've known is success, the fans in Las Vegas, at least some success. And they're going to have to make some kind of trade, some kind of splash eventually. And I think they will, though. They still have money left over, right? Like $6 million?
It's a little less now because they signed the backup goalie.
Oh, the worst goalie in the league? I forgot. Okay.
They gave him $1.8 million, which is insane. It's not even that much money, but it's like, okay, he was terrible. What are you doing over here? And then they kept one of their own players, Pavel Dorofeyev, who was a restricted free agent.
Right.
They gave him $1.8 million as well, and he was only making like $800,000 last year. Wow. So he's going to be expected to play a big role next season. The problem they're going to run into right now is they have Jack Eichel, Mark Stone, Tomas Hertl, William Karlsson. Those are four really good forwards. You need six good forwards to make up your top two lines. Their fifth best forward is like Ivan Barbashev at this point, who's fine, but is nothing special. They don't have a sixth forward for their top two lines. Like, it's going to be Pavel Dorofeyev, who's 23 years old, has played like half of a season in the NHL. That guy's going to be playing as many minutes as Mark Stone does this upcoming season. So I'm a little confused why they didn't do much of anything yesterday. Basically sitting back and saying, we can lose six players from a team that got bounced in the first round and expect to win the Stanley Cup, I think is pretty foolish.
That's why I was a little surprised about the money with Marchessault that they wouldn't give him, and even the fifth year, because by then, you know, this happens in all sports where it looks like a lot of money. By then, $5 million, it looked like maybe, you know, a Snickers bar or something. That's not a big deal. Like, I don't know why they would even, looking down the future, would care.
And depending on how this front office views, like, the championship window idea, they're probably not true contenders 3 years from now. Like, they've probably got two, maybe 3 years to truly make a run at another Stanley Cup. And then after that, we'll see where they are. Like, Jack Eichel's got two more years on his contract.
Right.
And then at that point, Jack Eichel will be 29, and if he continues to play well, we'll be looking at like a $10, $11, $12 million contract. But that's that. I think there's a two-year window. If they think they can extend beyond that, then that would make the Marchessault decision a little bit smarter, and maybe this is not a rebuilding year, but like we'll take a step back for 1 year and then try to be good again. But in reality, they probably have 2 years to go win another Stanley Cup. And I think this yesterday in free agency, they didn't really help themselves very much.
I've seen you say that they don't really develop players well. They're usually making trades and you know, other things. Why is that, though?
They were, I think this all stems back to the very first year when they were much, much better than expected, because they came out in their first year, they had a bunch of picks and a bunch of younger players. And then they were good in year one when the front, they didn't expect to be good. The front office did not expect to be good. And so then they started like adding players. And the best way to do that was to trade away their picks or trade away the guys that they had just drafted. And I think they've just been in the cycle of that since that first year. And then that next offseason of, well, we're better than we thought we were in year one. Our window to win a title is right now.
Right.
So we don't care about our prospects. And unlike a normal franchise who's been around for 30 years or 50 years or 100 years and has, you know, a long time to be able to develop prospects, they've been around for 7 years.
Right.
And that entire 7 years has been a championship window. So they've been like, we don't need the 21-year-old. We need the 26-year-old.
And it's more similar to Major League Baseball, where it takes a while to have these guys. Because, you know, in NBA, you expect a first-round pick to start right away. Right. Some of these guys will be 5 years later coming into the leagues.
The kid they drafted in the first round, he's 18. He's going to Providence to play college hockey.
Right,
like,
right.
He's not even joining the professional ranks.
Yeah, he might not even make it there. Yeah,
We know.
Right. Like, well, I mean, for other reasons even. You never know.
But, like, he's going to college. So, that's how kind of weird it is when you draft players. And then, all right, you're part of our organization. Go to Providence for 2, 3, 4 years.
I've seen it happen with guys I played with in baseball who just wind up in the minors and then you just never really heard about them again.
Yeah. So it takes a while. But it's just, I don't really think, I mean, they haven't developed prospects and they do at some point need to be better at that. But I think it's more about, hey, we can win a championship right now. And that's been the mindset since year one, halfway through year one. So it's just been a churn on the prospects and the picks. They still should have done better. Like, they still have had some prospects that did not work out. And, like, they're going to rely on Brendan Brisson, who was their first-round pick last year or 2 years ago. I can't remember. They're going to rely on him to play next year. And he was not good in the regular season. He only played because of, like, oh, we've got six guys that are injured, and you got to be in the lineup. As soon as they were close to healthy, he was back out of the lineup. So we'll see if he actually makes any sort of difference, because he might be playing on the second line at some point this season. Because the other part of this, they're not very deep. They got a lot of injury problems in the past.
Yeah.
Like the idea that they're going to stay healthy.
Right.
Probably not accurate.
That happens a lot, too, though, in sports. Like, I've seen in baseball, a guy will be hitting 200 in the minors, and all of a sudden he'll come up to the major leagues and he's hitting 350. You're like, what? Why didn't you do this before?
Well, nobody hits 350 anymore.
Well, regardless.
350, you're the greatest player of all time.
I'm exaggerating, but you know what I mean? Like,
that's
a guy,
not allowed around here.
A guy in the NFL, he'll be a wide receiver and like not really that great. All his scouting reports have a bunch of cons on him. Then all of a sudden he's one of the better receivers. I mean, stuff like that happens.
Puka Nacua.
Yeah, there you go.
Coming up next, I yell about soccer.
The idea was that they were going to progress. I haven't seen any progression.
Well, clearly the 90 seconds we lost in stoppage time weren't added. Would it have made a difference? That's it. That's the end. The United States is done at the Copa America.
Live from the Findlay Toyota ESPN Las Vegas studios, this is the Press Box with Graney and Bischoff on ESPN Las Vegas.
Featuring Greg Salerno.
What a disaster, Greg.
Yeah, you mean him playing the old guy's voice or... Oh, yeah. No, I know. I was booing. I was booing in my head the whole time listening to that.
You were booing Danny or U.S. soccer?
I was booing U.S. soccer after I heard Danny do that.
Okay. Yeah. The United States lost to Uruguay yesterday, 1-0. That combined with Panama beating Bolivia 3-1 means Panama advances and the United States is out of Copa America. As I told you yesterday, the conversation now has shifted to Greg Berhalter may or may not getting fired.
Well, you were against it yesterday. How about now?
So first off, let me read you this. The U.S. Soccer Federation tweeted out, "Our tournament performance fell short of our expectations. We must do better. We will be conducting a comprehensive review of our performance in Copa America and how best to improve the team and results as we look towards the 2026 World Cup."
Yeah, he's gone.
Berhalter, this is like the first true failure under Greg Berhalter. Like they've had some other tournaments where they lost, but like they got knocked out by the Netherlands in the World Cup. That's a top 10 team in the world. If we're firing American coaches for losing to top 10 teams in the world in the World Cup, we're never going to have a coach, that type of stuff. This one truly was a disaster because at the end of the day, the United States either needed to beat Uruguay or get a draw while down to 10 men against Panama. They do either one of those two things, and they're still playing. They're still in this tournament, and they were unable to do either of those things.
How did Bolivia do versus Panama? I didn't even see the...
They tied the game at 1-1. They actually didn't play too poorly.
So we got what we wanted, that America wasn't able to hold
up
the end of the bargain.
We wanted Bolivia to tie the game.
Oh.
They tied the game during the game, but they lost 3-1. So them losing 3-1.
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, we needed to beat Uruguay last night because Panama did beat Bolivia.
Right.
There was a moment where Bolivia tied the game in the second half, and it was like, oh, we might advance because Panama blows it against Bolivia, but that didn't happen. We needed to beat Uruguay, or if we go back, beating Uruguay is not the big issue. It's the one before where we lost Panama. We had to play with down a man because we got a red card in the 18th minute because Tim Way is an idiot and made that a lot more difficult, but we still need to get a draw, which both of those things, even beating Uruguay, we should be able to do at home. We should be able to do when we're playing in the United States, and we couldn't do either one of those things. And neither of those, like that, ultimately that's not good enough. Now, the problem is that when we're evaluating Greg Berhalter, when we're evaluating the manager and like who's going to be the best manager going into the future, none of the three games we just played were like a disaster. Like, we didn't play poorly in any of the three games. We played Bolivia. We beat them 2-0. Should we have scored two more? Probably, but whatever. We beat them 2-0. We played Panama. We took a stupid red card in the 18th minute, and then we had to play down a man, and I thought we played really well. We played exactly how we should have played. We missed an opportunity to take the lead in the 83rd minute that was like a 0.5 expected goals. They scored 90 seconds later on a shot that had a 0.2 expected goal rate. So we had a better chance than them. We just didn't finish it, and Panama did. And then last night, we played fine against Uruguay, right? We didn't win the game, but Uruguay is one of the 10 best teams in the world probably right now,
yeah.
And we played perfectly fine. But we didn't beat Panama or get a tie, and we didn't beat Uruguay. And ultimately, those are the things you need to do. If it were up to me, I wouldn't fire Greg Berhalter. But I understand why he would get fired, and I don't think it's a bad thing if he does get fired. I don't I don't think we're going to hire another coach and he's going to be significantly better or worse than Greg Berhalter.
Yeah, it's all about expectations. Like if you're the Yankees coach or if you're the Lakers coach or if you're a team, you know, the Cowboys every year is like we have to win a Super Bowl or whatever. If you're a Super Bowl or bust, championship or bust type of team, which America was becoming, people were starting to expect them to win or expect them to do better.
We're going to win the World Cup still.
There you go.
Don't worry.
It's exactly. So if that's your expectations, though, then you can't have these kind of screw-ups, you know? I mean, that's just the way it always goes. A coach always gets fired.
Yeah, and we'll see what they actually do. But I would be surprised if we hired a manager that makes a significant difference one way or the other. Because here's there's two problems that are kind of combined here for U.S. soccer. Number one, we're never going to be viewed as like this must-have job for soccer managers. In fact, almost all international teams, their jobs are not going to be viewed as must-have because anybody that's a great manager would rather coach a professional team.
Yeah.
You'd rather be the manager of Manchester United or Barcelona or Bayern Munich than of the United States or even of Argentina or Brazil or France,
right?
Because it's just a better job in that regards. So what's our pool of coaches to select from? That's one problem. The second problem, and this goes to evaluating coaches and how good they're going to be or how good they are, international soccer is crazy small sample sizes. We just played three games.
Right.
Greg Berhalter might get fired over a three-game sample size.
Right, yeah.
In which we played down a man for 70 minutes of 270. Basically, 25% of that three-game sample size, we played down a man. So, there's nothing else in the world where your sample size is three games. Like, maybe if we judge coaches in the NFL on their playoff success only, like Mike McCarthy might get fired because he goes one and done in the playoffs seemingly every year. But even then, you get a 17-game regular season before that
right.
we judge you on as well. There's nothing else where you're like, all right, you get three games, and if you screw that up, you're done. So the sample sizes are small to, one, evaluate, but also, who's next? Like, the World Cup's in 2026. I think there's a Gold Cup and a Nations League before then. So we're going to play in two tournaments before then, but these are going to be the same thing where it's super small sample sizes. How are we truly going to judge the next guy and how good he is? We're not. We're just going to hope we're going to be in the World Cup. He's going to get three group stage games, and we'll see. We might get bounced in the World Cup then, and we'll be like, oh, wow, those three games were bad too. But it's ultimately super, super small sample sizes.
And Tyler Bischoff's expert opinion, how important is coaching in, like, in NFL? You have to have a good head coach,
oh.
I think. In NBA, you could have a collection of players, and the coach could just go play poker or something, and it doesn't really matter a lot of times, you know? So, like, how important is the coach in soccer?
It's incredibly important, but I think it matters a lot more for, like, professional club soccer than it does for international teams. Because, like, for example, I'm an Arsenal fan. Last year, Arsenal finished second in the Premier League. And then in the summer, in the offseason, they identified players they wanted to go with. They went and got a new goalkeeper. They went and got a new midfielder because they played a certain way and these players fit that certain way. That matters because the coach is the one that's identifying, this is how I want to play. These are the players that fit that. I can go get this player from another team. You can't do that in international soccer. You have to play with the guys that are born in that country. So, do you need to change the way you play to fit your team? Absolutely. But you can't just be like, all right, let's plug this guy in. Like, for example, our best right back tore his ACL like 4 months ago. We had to play a different right back who's rarely played for us in
right.
this tournament. He was fine. He's not the reason we lost, but we couldn't just find a better replacement. We just had to pick one that's American.
Sure.
And, like, I think it's a lot more important in professional soccer than, say, international soccer. Because the other thing, they've been together for, I think, 2 weeks now, maybe 3 weeks for this tournament. Like,
that's
crazy. You get 2 weeks. Now, Berhalter's been here for a long time. It's been, you get like two or three week spans over the course of a
yeah.
year. And in theory, you have the coach over and over, and the guys know what he wants you to do. But you bring in a new guy, and it's going to be, all right, we got 7 days to train, and then we're playing a game, learn everything he wants to do. Meanwhile, it's going to be completely different from what you're doing with your professional team. So, it matters a lot. I just don't think it's going to make a huge difference for us.
Yeah.
Because, one, we're not going to hire some world-renowned, amazing manager. And two, the sample sizes are going to be too small for them to come in and make a huge difference.
That's got to be tough to gamble on because, like, if let's say starting the NFL preseason August 1st and then, like, the Super Bowl is September 9th or something.
Yeah, that's basically what it is. Yeah.
Like, how in the world would you know who's going to win?
It's like the preseason's August 1st. If you don't win your first two out of your first three games by August 15th, you're done. That's what it is. And for the most part, Berhalter's been pretty successful. This was a disaster. Yeah. Absolute disaster of a tournament. Coming up next, David Roth joins the show.
He is adorned in flannel and still might not have a building super. He has a turtle who loves to eat rocks. David Roth from Defector is here to tell us about his uninstalled appliances. Subscribe to The Distraction, a multitude production for Defector. Listen to The Distraction wherever you get your podcasts.
David, aren't you supposed to not be talking to us this week?
Yeah, that was the idea. We got our asses handed to us by American Airlines on Sunday, and I was telling Danny, it was just like, we just came back home. Like, we just spent the day at the airport waiting for them to cancel our flight. And then when they did, we, like, just got in the cab, and it was Sunday night, and we just did the normal things we would do on a Sunday night, which is not, you know, there's worse things, but I was really hoping I'd be in Maine right now, and I'm totally not.
Wait, what? What, anything abnormal happened, or just whether there was a pilot who was over his hours? Like, what happened?
It was weather stuff, but it was really kind of hard to tell what was going on. Like, we got on the plane, we were, like, out on the tarmac, and then they were like, weather's really bad in Boston, we're going to take you back to the terminal. We got off, you know, we ate something and hung around for a while, and then they got everybody back. Some people boarded the plane twice. We came very close to doing that, and then they got people off the plane again, and the pilot, it kind of, like, reminded me of when I was a kid and we'd be on, like, a long car trip. Like, you never want to have, like, a pilot remind you of your dad, necessarily. Like the frustrated fifth hour of a seven-hour drive version of your dad. But, like, he clearly had, like, dinner reservations in Nashville that night that he was realizing he was not going to make. And he was really trying to just go for it. Like, I think the second boarding was him basically trying to sneak one in. Like, if he could just, like, get around the air traffic controllers and get in the air, like, just then he would be able to get to Portland, and then he'd be able to get to Nashville. But, no, he was staying at the Holiday Inn Express by Citi Field with the rest of his crew, I'm sure, that night.
Well, I'm glad you're here, because I need you to explain how Grimace has made the Mets a competent baseball team.
It's really exciting. I would have thought that there was no power on earth that was going to get them there this year. But it seems like there's a bunch of different theories as to what it is that got the Mets. Like, they're 500 now, which is not amazing, but it's the National League, so that puts them squarely in wild card contention. And they were 11 games under 500 when June started, so it's still, you know, I guess a win. But the idea there is, so some people are pegging it to when the team changed their logo on Twitter for Pride Month. Some people are saying that it was that the team's winning streak started when Grimace threw out the first pitch in a game against the Nats at the beginning of June. I did not see the video of Grimace throwing the ball. That's the one part of it that sort of doesn't exactly scan to me. And then my favorite theory on what turned them around is that Jose Iglesias, who's this super well-traveled utility guy, I don't need to tell you who Jose Iglesias is. We're all normal people here. But he I guess, records music in his spare time. Like, he just sort of messes around in a home studio. And he, during the off season, he recorded a song called OMG that's about how you shouldn't worry too much and life is actually good. And the team started playing it after games. And then he recently, I think, like, last week, he performed it after a game. Like, they just, after they won, they, like, turned the lights in the stadium down and gave him a microphone, and he's wearing his uniform, and he just got out there and sang it on the field. So I want to believe that Jose Iglesias' Spanish language music career is as much a factor in this as Grimace.
I love the idea of the concert after the game. Do you think they would have done that if they had lost?
Probably not, although it's the Mets. You don't know. Like, they've definitely had some stuff. They used to schedule concerts after the game, and as I recall, they had a pretty bad record during that. So it would be the sort of thing where, like, 50 Cent would be performing after the game, but then the Mets would lose, like, 13-2, and, like, the only people left would be, like, people that were too drunk to get on the 7 train. They were just like, all right, fine, I'll watch 50 Cent. Which I think that in this case, I'd love to believe that they would have just bagged it. Like, if the team had blown a save or whatever, they'd be like, you'll get him tomorrow, Jose. But I think, you know, whatever. This is the power of Jose Iglesias' OMG. They couldn't have lost.
Sticking in New York, my Yankees are 3-7 in their last 10. They are now in second place statistically to the Orioles. Should they get the Hamburglar out there, Julio Iglesias? Like, what can the Yankees do here? What is going on?
I was going to say, like, it's tough. You don't want the version, like the Burger King that they brought back with the terrifying plastic face. Yeah. I don't think that helps anybody, really. It just scares the kids. I mean, I've watched the Yankees against the Mets recently, and they're still really good to me. I don't know. It's weird, though. That lineup is as much as the Dodgers, but I think, you know, like maybe the Dodgers wanted slightly longer. The best part of the Yankees lineup is incredibly good. And then the rest of the lineup is still just guys that you can get. If you're in like a regular 10-team fantasy league, like everybody that's batting below number five, you could just sign. That's just a $0 waiver claim. Like, and I don't know how they wound up like that. I mean, because like Soto and Judge have been incredibly good.
Yeah.
And I think any team that's got those guys is, you know, as much of a shot to win the World Series as any other team in baseball. But there's still a lot of, like, Jamai Jones and Ben Rice in the monitors, and I don't know how you solve for that other than spending money, which it seems like Hank doesn't want to do.
As our random Clippers fan, they bad now?
Yeah, I mean, I think on purpose. I don't know. I was talking to my Clippers fan friend the other day, and we were both sort of, like, trying to figure out what the game plan is there, and it seems... It's definitely not getting better, but they're not really tanking either. I mean, they don't have any picks. Like, one of the weird things that a friend pointed out the other day is that right around the moment that the Thunder are starting to peak, if the Clippers are going sort of in the toilet, as it seems like they are, that, like, a few years from now, the Thunder are going to be a championship contender that just randomly has the fifth pick in the draft. Because all those Clips picks have not transferred yet. So there's still... I mean, I think the little moves they've made during the offseason, like losing Paul George for nothing's not great. Recommitting to James Harden for the last two viable years of his career, or however many, certainly the last two in which he's likely to make $35 million. You know, I don't know. Like, he was pretty good last year until he wasn't. It's just the way that they have sort of started swapping out, you know, just basically replacing Paul George with, like, Derek Jones Jr. and replacing Russell Westbrook with Kevin Porter Jr. Like, it's kind of hard to find a basketball justification for it. And if the idea is saving money, then, you know, I mean, I guess good for Steve Ballmer. That's great. I hope he donates it responsibly. But, yeah, they do kind of feel like a team that's gone from if everything goes right, it's a championship contender to if everything goes more or less as you expect it to, they're like playing in the, you know, whatever, they're the 10 seed battling for a spot in the postseason at all.
Do you like the Sixers strategy of now having two guys that can watch Maxey play 5-on-1 in the playoffs while they're both injured on the bench?
I kind of respect that they're doubling down on it. Yeah. The idea of just basically that they're like, well, we've had a problem in the past, which is that one of our superstars isn't available. And I think it might be good if we had two of our superstars not be available. That's twice as powerful.
Yeah.
But it is really strange. Like, I like George, and I think that he's a good fit there in the sense that he's a really good defender. There's, you know, ways that you can use him that hopefully would not take quite as much tread off the tire. But he also played in 5 years with the Clippers, he played in like 260 games. Like, I mean, you really just can't count on him to play 65 games in a season. Like, not even in a load management sort of way. Like, he won't be healthy enough to do it. And as we've seen, as great as Maxey is, and I think Maxey is going to be like a super duper star. Like, I love watching him, and I think he's still improving. You kind of like him by himself with the, you know, the rotation guys in the playoffs is not a team that hangs around very long.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, they've got a real issue with the second round of the playoffs anyway. And I don't know exactly what all they were going to do to get them past it. But I would say the thing to prioritize would be having a guy who is available. And that is not the type of guy they pursued.
Are you still going to Maine?
Yeah, I'm going today. Hopefully, I don't know. I shouldn't be talking like I know what's going to happen there. But yeah, the weather's better, so we're just going to go back to the airport and basically do Sunday all over again, but hopefully actually get there this time. It's kind of weird. We had, when you like travel, you get a lot of like automated sort of like emails and texts from the places that you stay. And the hotel that we just straight up did not stay at for the last 2 days, like I got a credit from them. I talked to them on the phone. But right before I got your call this morning, they sent me a text asking me to rate my stay there. And I was like, there's not like an NA option. Like, so I don't know what I guess I'm just going to like leave it on read or whatever. But it was kind of a nice reminder that I was supposed to be, I don't know, eating lobster rolls right now, and instead it's just like leftover Thai food and taking the garbage out before we leave.
Well, enjoy another airport meal after you get stuck there for 10 hours again.
Yeah, there's a pot belly we haven't tried yet, so I'm really excited about that. Thank you, guys.
He's David Roth from The Factor. Always great to talk to as David Roth. See you, David.
Take care. Bye.
So there's David Roth. You guys want the word of the day today? For our weekly vacation giveaway. It's the summer of fun, thanks to ESPN Las Vegas and Planet Nissan. We're giving away a vacation. 8 weeks we're doing this. This week's trip is here in Las Vegas. If you win this and you don't want to take the trip in Las Vegas because you live here, you can take $3,000 in cash. But you do get high roller tickets. You do get a Cirque show. You do get a pair of tickets to a boxing match. And you get to go to the Sphere. So there's a lot of stuff involved there. And $1,000 spending cash. Today's word is Europe. Good luck. EUROPE. Europe. Don't mess it up. Text Europe to 702-364-1100. That's all you got to do to get entered to win. Just text Europe to 702-364-1100. And you are entered to win. That's it. Good luck.
You're listening to The Press Box on ESPN Las Vegas.
Featuring Greg Salerno.
There you go. I didn't even have to use it today.
All right. This is by request of Danny, and it's a good request, Danny. I should have gotten to this already. But the United States and their loss to Uruguay last night. I am in no way blaming the referees for why the United States was eliminated from Copa America. All right? Yeah. That's not why. They are not playing anymore.
They have some blame.
But not really. I mean, it was pretty bad against Panama, too, but, like, not really. The refereeing last night was horrific. It was abhorrent. Like, Uruguay scored one goal in the game. It was offside.
Oh, I saw a picture.
It was offside.
Yeah, somebody's like, how is this not offside?
It's probably Danny. Uruguay got a free kick, and they score off the free kick. It got checked by VAR to see if it was offside, and they ruled it a good goal. When they showed the VAR replay of this goal, their replay had it as offside. Because what happens when they check is they draw a line on the field for the furthest defensive player's, you know, foot or whatever body part is furthest back, and then they draw a line on the field where the attacking player, who would be on or offside, where his furthest body part is. They had the line, and then they had the knee of the Uruguayan player that scored, and the knee was past the line. They showed a replay that said it was offside and then let it stand.
Now, is this one of those angles that, like, sometimes the goal line...
No, the whole point of the lines is to make up for the angle. Yes, you are okay. Right. The angle would be deceiving, but that's why they draw the lines, because they draw it from sideline to sideline. If it's a straight line, then you're going to know. They showed a replay where it was offside and just let it stand. They also, because the way they do it is they take a freeze frame of the video they're using.
Yeah.
They took the wrong frame. They used a frame too early from what they should have used. So they used the wrong frame, and even then it was offside and they let it stand.
So why are we not taking to the streets right now?
It's unbelievable, because we still had to score a goal at the end of the day to win that game, and we didn't score a goal.
Well, that's fine then.
Yeah. Also, the referee, I don't know if he knows the rules of soccer, but he broke a rule of soccer. So there was a play where one of our players committed a foul, and it was a foul, and he went to give our player a yellow card. Now, as he is pulling out his yellow card to give our player a yellow card, Uruguay takes their free kick quickly, and the referee allows it to happen. When you're giving a player a yellow card, the ball cannot be live. if you're stopping the game to give a yellow card, the game has to be stopped until the referee restarts the game.
That's like letting the pitcher throw a pitch while the guy's in the on-deck circle.
Yeah, or like while you're ejecting the batter, you're like, here comes strike two. He has the yellow card in the air while Uruguay takes off, and he just lets it happen. It's like he didn't understand the rules of soccer. And then after the game, one of the funniest things that happened, Christian Pulisic, the captain of Team USA, not 100% sure what he was saying because it was a video and you can't hear him, but most people seem to be pretty sure Christian Pulisic was telling the refs after the game, why aren't you celebrating with Uruguay?
Nice.
And he went to shake their hands after saying that, and the ref refused to shake his hands.
Good.
I love Christian Pulisic.
There should be an investigation. We should be in the streets.
So
America has been wronged.
So you want a fun story about this referee? His name is Kevin Ortega. In 2022, he was the referee of a game in Argentina involving a team called Boca Juniors, which don't get confused by junior. They're one of the best teams in Argentina. They're just called Boca Juniors because it's a weird name. Boca Juniors won that game 1-0, and what was described a controversial penalty call awarded by this referee. After the game, the police in Argentina raided the referee's locker room and found Boca Junior jerseys that were given to the referees before the game by Boca Juniors.
Dude, why is this guy, where would this happen?
That happened in Argentina.
No, I'm saying, where was this actually played? The city this game was actually
Kansas,
Kansas City.
Now, the tournament's put on
You know what to do, Kansas City.
The tournament's put on by the South American Federation.
Put those
or
ribs
whatever.
Down and arrest this man.
Anywhere else on this planet, that ref might not have made it home.
Oh, dude, if he was in Iraq, he would have been hung upside down, his feet beaten with the sticks or whatever they did. I saw in a documentary on that.
Good save.
I did.
So he was unbelievably bad last night. Like, and to be fair, the offside call is not his decision. Like, he was just, their VAR is a separate referee, somebody somewhere else watching a video.
Yeah.
And he just tells him, hey, that was on or offside. So that wasn't on him. That was on an inexplicable poor use of VAR.
But what's the recourse then if something like nothing?
They might say something. Like, Canada, in their most recent game, one of their players elbowed somebody else in the face, which should be a red card. And we have VAR for if the referee misses it, because it happens off the ball and there's one ref, they can't see everything.
Sure.
There's VAR to go back and check and say that was a red card. They didn't check for this elbow. After the game, they came out and said, we missed that. That should have been a red card.
This is a travesty.
It's unbelievable how bad it is.
This is terrible.
I don't know what's like, normally I watch soccer and think the refs are terrible. There's only one ref for 22 players. It's a terrible setup. I can't believe how bad this tournament has been, because it's been horrible. This tournament's been genuinely horribly officiated.
If we don't invade Argentina and Uruguay by tomorrow, something's wrong.
They kept hammering that this was only that guy's seventh international game.
Then why is he there?
He's ever reffed?
Yeah.
There's no way this guy can be a part of any ref squad in the World Cup.
I might be repeating something that's incorrect that I am misremembering on the internet. I believe he was supposed to work the most recent World Cup, but then that whole taking jerseys from the team in Argentina got him kicked out of the World Cup.
Now he's bowling with Angel Hernandez.